way, a conspiracy, you say, but where are the documents? I am bold enough to assert, in keeping with the fundamental requirements of the science of criminal procedure, that in cases of conspiracy such demands cannot be put. On this point, one of the defense lawyers, inadequately briefed, was to refer approvingly to documents available in the case. The popular rage line was heavily played. They blow up mines, they burn down workshops, they wreck trains, they mutilate and kill hundreds of our best people, sons of our country. 800 workers in the Gorlovka Nitrate Fertilizer Works, through Pravda, communicated the names of the best Stakhanovites in those works who died by the treacherous hand of the diversionists. Here is the list of these victims: Lunov, Stakhanovite, born 1902. Yudin, a talented engineer, born 1913. Kurkin, a member of the Young Communist League, Stakhanovite, 23 years of age. Strelnikova, girl shock brigade worker, born 1913. Moisets, shock brigade worker, also born 1913. These were killed, over a dozen were injured. Maximenko, a Staldianovite who fulfilled his norm of 125% to 150%, was killed. Namikin, one of the best shock brigade workers, sacrificed his 10 days leave to go down the Central Naya pit, and there somebody waited for him and killed him. Shot fire Yurov, one of the men who took part in the fighting against the white Chinese, was killed. Lanin, an old miner, a participant in the Civil War, was killed. And so on and so forth. As a result, Vyshinsky felt justified in shouting, as he perorated, "I do not stand here alone. The victims may be in their graves, but I feel that they are standing here beside me, pointing at the dock, at you, accused, with their mutilated arms, which have moldered in the graves to which you sent them. I am not the only accuser. I am joined in my accusation by the whole of our people. I accuse these heinous criminals who deserve only one punishment, death by shooting." Unlike the defendants in the Zinoviev trial, some of the junior accused this time had defense counsel. These took a different view of their duties from those in bourgeois courts. Broad started by saying, in a locus classicus for Stalinist defense lawyers, "Comrade judges, I will not conceal from you the exceptionally difficult, the unprecedentedly difficult position in which the defense finds itself in this case. First of all, comrade judges, the counsel for defense is a son of his country. He, too, is a citizen of the great Soviet Union, and the great indignation, anger and horror which is now felt by the whole population of our country, old and young, the feeling which the prosecutor so strikingly expressed in his speech, cannot but be shared by counsel. In this case, comrade judges, there is no dispute about the facts. Comrade prosecutor was quite right when he said that from all points of view, from the point of view of documents available in the case, from the point of view of the examination of the witnesses who were summoned here, and cross-examination of the accused, all this has deprived us of all possibility of disputing the evidence. All the facts have been proved, and in this sphere the defense does not intend to enter into any controversy with the procurator. Nor can there be any controversy with the procurator concerning the appraisal of the political and moral aspects of the case. Here, too, the case is so clear, the political appraisal made here by the procurator is so clear, that the defense cannot but wholly and entirely associate itself with that part of his speech. When the defense had finished, the last pleas followed. Pyatakov ended his, with downcast eyes, "In a few hours you will pass your sentence. And here I stand before you in filth, crushed by my own crimes, bereft of everything through my own fault, a man who has lost his party, who has no friends, who has lost his family, who has lost his very self." Roddick's most useful contribution was to make the point that there were still semi-Trotskyites, quarter-Trotskyites, 1/8 Trotskyites, people who helped us, not knowing of the terrorist organization but sympathizing with us, people who from liberalism, from a front against the party, gave us this help. This was in fact a charter for disposing of any critics of the purge, even if 7/8 Stalinist. Yet while both abject and cogent in his presentation of the charges against Trotsky and the accused, he managed to make a few two-edged remarks. He continued to dissociate himself and his co-defendants from the direct German connection. "But when I read about Ulberg and asked others whether they had known of the existence of Ulberg, and none of them had heard about him, it became clear to me that in addition to the cadres who had passed through his school, Trotsky was organizing agents who had passed through the school of German fascism." And finally he repeated the fact that it was only on his word, and Pyatakov's, that the entire case was erected. What proofs are there in support of this fact? In support of this fact there is the evidence of two people, the testimony of myself, who received the directives and the letters from Trotsky, which, unfortunately, I Burned, and the testimony of Pyatakov, who spoke to Trotsky. All the testimony of the other accused rests on our testimony. If you are dealing with mere criminals and spies, on what can you base your conviction that what we have said is the truth, the firm truth? The others took the more usual line. Drobnys, Muralov, and Boguslavsky referred to their splendid records and proletarian origins. Sokolnikov spoke at length, and Siroborokov very briefly. All the politicals, though to very different degrees, attacked Trotsky in person. Arnold pleaded weak, low political development, as well he might. At 3 a.m. on 30th of January, the verdict was pronounced. Death to all except Sokolnikov and Radek, as not directly participating in the organization and execution of the various crimes, and Arnold, who got 10 years each, and Stroilov, who got 8. A story circulating in NKVD circles has it that Stalin was asked for Radek's life to be spared by Lion Feuchtwanger, as the price for his agreeing to write his book, Moscow 1937, justifying the trials, which Stalin was particularly anxious to have written to counter the effect of Andrei Gide's retort to LURSS. The sentence on Arnold, supposed actually to have carried out a terrorist act, contrasts extraordinarily with those of the previous failed assassins like Fritz David. It has been suggested that Stalin had been so entertained by his evidence that, when he drafted the sentences, he indulged the caprice of showing special clemency. When Radek heard the verdict, his face showed relief. He turned to his fellow accused with a shrug and a guilty smile, as though unable to explain his luck. Trademark. He is said to have been later retried on a charge of suppressing evidence against Tukhachevsky and sentenced to death but reprieved. A recent official account has him killed in jail, May 19, 1939. There have long been reports that he was murdered by a criminal prisoner, acting on orders, and it is now confirmed that both he and Sokolnikov were killed in prison by cellmates in May 1939. Stroilov and Arnold were shot in 1941. The relations of several prisoners are identified in camps or jail. Radek's daughter got 8 years. Drobnys's wife was seen in 1936 in the Krasnoyarsk isolator. She had become almost completely deaf as the result of treatment in the Lubyanka. Muralov's brother was shot, his 16-year-old son was sentenced to labor camp, and died of dystrophy in Dalstroy in 1943, and a number of other relatives, including his niece Yelka, were also imprisoned. Galina Serebryakova, who spent nearly 20 years in Siberia from this time, had been married to two leading victims, Siroborokov and Sokolnikov. Through all this, she retained her party-mindedness, and after her rehabilitation spoke up warmly at writers' meetings in 1962 and 1963 against the liberalizing trends. During the early months of 1963, when heavy pressure was being put on the liberal writers, Khrushchev was able to point to her as an example, comparing her with Ilya Ehrenberg, who during Stalin's lifetime had praised him warmly and lived comfortably, but was now departing from party principles. There had been a progressive increase in the incredibility of the trials. At first, 1936, the party was only asked to accept the idea that Zinoviev and Kamenev, together with some genuine Trotskyites, had plotted to murder the leadership and had in fact been responsible for Kirov's death. Although the execution of Zinoviev and the rest aroused a great revulsion, there were other factors. First of all, though it seems unlikely that many members of the Central Committee could have believed the charges literally, or taken the confessions at face value, and there were certainly rumors circulating about the true role of the NKVD in the Kirov killing, still the Zinoviev opposition had really fought Stalin by all the means at its disposal, in a political fight in which almost all the present committee had been on Stalin's side. They had compromised themselves by lying their way back into the party, as was quite evident. And it was at least possible that the assassination of Kirov was objectively Zinoviev's responsibility. As to the more obvious falsehoods of the trial itself, the party was quite used to falsehood for party reasons, and, if it came to that, to fake trials designed to impress the public. Stalin was, it might have been felt, getting rid of irreconcilable enemies. None of this applied to Pyatakov and his fellow defendants. And, at the same time, the case produced all the anomalies and oddities of the previous one, in fact in an exaggerated form. As with the Zinoviev group, it was alleged that Pyatakov and his fellow defendants had organized a vast underground of assassins. Radek referred, perhaps ironically, in his evidence to scores of wandering terrorist groups waiting for the chance to assassinate some leader of the party. At least 14 separate groups or individuals are named who had the task of assassinating Stalin, several of them, Kaganovich, Molotov, Voroshilov, Orjonikidze, Kosyur, Postishev, Ik, Yazhov, and Beria. Again, in spite of the protection and complicity of high officials everywhere, they had been unable to carry out any overt act, successfully or unsuccessfully, with the sole exception of the attempt to murder Molotov, and even this did not sound very professional. Indeed, the sentencing of Arnold to only 10 years imprisonment was virtually an admission that he was not a political enthusiast. Why, when the conspiracy brimmed with fanatical Trotskyites, they should have entrusted this suicide operation to such a figure was not explained. And the plotters were not even able to assassinate Kaganovich, though several of the men closest to him in his governmental post, like Lifshitz, Serebrakov, and Konashev, were members of the conspiracy. Vyshinsky had to deal with the fact that Zinoviev and his colleagues, who had supposedly made full confessions, had, as it now appeared, concealed much of the story. He said flatly, as we saw, that they lied and deceived when they already had one foot in the grave. But in that case, while their confessions of fact might have been limited to what they could not deny, their abject expressions of guilt must have been insincere, that is, everything they said in their final speeches was retrospectively cancelled. People who believed in the trials, however, had no difficulty in reconciling, or rather ignoring, these contradictory versions. A minor anomaly is, as we have seen, that the accused now admitted that they had plotted with Zinoviev and Kamenev to kill Molotov as well as the other leaders. Zinoviev and Kamenev had not confessed to this crime, since they had not been required to do so. Once again, important plotters were mentioned and not produced. When the old Bolshevik Bieloborodov, who had ordered the execution of the royal family, was implicated in a fashion which could not be cleared up properly, Vyshinsky remarked, "So now it will be necessary to ask Bieloborodov himself." But Bieloborodov was not produced, then or ever. And the same applies, of course, to Smilga, Preberzhansky, Uglanov, and other important links, who were simply omitted without explanation. In addition there were, of course, the factual mistakes, and particularly the Oslo visit. Yet in a summary published in England under the sponsorship of the Anglo-Russian Parliamentary Committee, a preface by the Moscow correspondent of the Daily Herald, R. T. Miller, could say they confessed because the state's collection of evidence forced them to. No other explanation fits the facts. Neil MacLean, Labour MP for Govan and chairman of this committee, noted in a foreword, "Practically every foreign correspondent present at the trial, with the exception of course of the Japanese and German, have expressed themselves as very much impressed by the weight of evidence presented by the prosecution and the sincerity of the confessions of the accused." This is an interesting, though untrue, smear on correspondents who thought otherwise. They were clearly in the same boat as the minority of committed fascists, excluded from the company of all decent folk. This is not the earliest or the only use of this polemical method. Even when the trial was in progress, Pravda published a long article about how a British lawyer, Dudley Collard, had described it, in the Daily Herald, as judicially unexceptionable. Dota. On January 27, 1937, 3 days before the verdict was handed down, Pravda had printed a more suitable item, an idealized portrait of Yuzhov with the information that he had been promoted to be General Commissar of State Security. In general, the press and public had mounted the usual violent campaign. When the verdict was announced, a crowd of 200,000 assembled in the Red Square, in a temperature of 27 degrees Celsius, to be harangued by Khrushchev and Shvernik, and to demonstrate spontaneously against the accused. They carried banners demanding the immediate carrying out of the death sentences, a demand readily acceded to by the authorities. The victims were fully rehabilitated just over 50 years later. The Orjonikidze suicide. Once again, the executions shocked the inner circles of the party. This time, Stalin had to face an immediate threat of firm opposition from a colleague who could not easily be dismissed, Sergei Orjonikidze. He had been double-crossed. Personally involved in the negotiations before the Pyatakov case, he had Stalin's assurance that Pyatakov would not be executed. According to a recent Soviet writer, Orjonikidze had already been shaken by the Hotel Bristol matter. Stalin had given him a promise to check such evidence. When Pyatakov was arrested, Stalin told Orjonikidze, "Pyatakov will not be executed." After the trial, Yuzhov told him, "Pyatakov is alive." Orjonikidze demanded a meeting with him, and this was promised. Yuzhov then told him that Pyatakov was in a state of shock after the trick played by the Norwegians. But Orjonikidze can hardly have been put off for long. He saw in all this a fatal precedent. It became clear that he would now carry on the fight against the purge by every means at his disposal. One account describes his behavior when he learned of the arrest of the head of one of the big trusts under his authority. He rang up Yuzhov, called him a filthy lickspittle, and demanded the documents in the case instantly. He then phoned Stalin on the direct circuit. By this time he was trembling, and his eyes were bloodshot. He shouted, "Koba, Why do you let the NKVD arrest my men without informing me? After some reply from Stalin, he interrupted, I demand that this authoritarianism cease. I am still a member of the Politburo. I am going to raise hell, Koba, if it's the last thing I do before I die. As usual, Stalin was not caught unprepared. In fact, though we usually think of the dispute between the two men about Pyatakov as a matter of Stalin wanting to get rid of Pyatakov and being willing to put up with trouble for more Janikidze in the process, it seems equally plausible that Stalin fully intended the destruction of Pyatakov as a blow against Orjanikidze too, and that the destruction of Orjanikidze was not simply a byproduct of the Pyatakov case, but something planned from the start. As we have suggested, it was perhaps as a political signal of some sort that at that trial Miralov, while freely admitting plans to kill Molotov and others, firmly denied any plans against Orjanikidze. Tilda Orjanikidze's elder brother, Papalia, had already been arrested in November 1936, and was shot after being tortured on 9 or 10 February. Stalin must therefore have been preparing to strike at his old colleague, but to have shown his hand only a short time before his final move. Meanwhile in the Transcaucasus, NKVD operatives were working to compel arrested people to give false testimonies against S. Orjanikidze. This would have been meaningless after Orjanikidze's death, and shows that Stalin was already preparing a dossier against his old friend. Similarly, former NKVD officers tried in November 1955 were charged with collecting slanderous material against him, and later of terrorist acts against members of his family and close friends in responsible posts. It is also the case that most of Orjanikidze's associates fell before or after his death, and that this is a reasonable indication of Stalin's feelings. Among them was Gvuldaria, Orjanikidze's nephew, the head of the great Makeyevka iron foundry. The leaders of Soviet heavy industry followed, Gurevich, a leading figure in the metallurgical industries, Tikhinsky, and many others. The top directors and industrialists, the men who had actually, under Pyatakov, created Stalin's one real achievement, disappeared. Orjanikidze himself was being increasingly harassed. Police officers arrived at Orjanikidze's flat with a search warrant. Humiliated and frantic with rage, Serga spent the rest of the night trying to get through to Stalin on the telephone. As morning came, he finally got through and heard the answer, "It is the sort of organ that is even liable to search my place. That is nothing extraordinary." On 17th of February, he had a conversation with Stalin lasting several hours. Stalin seems to have accused him of having earlier sympathized with the kulaks and now showing weakness and not enough real proletarian principledness. He made a last attempt to explain to Stalin, a friend of many years' standing, that dark forces were currently profiting from his pathological lifelong suspiciousness and that the party was being deprived of its best cadres. So far, the cadres the party was being deprived of were practically all oppositionists or ex-oppositionists, and Orjanikidze's formulation seems well suited to Pyatakov, and perhaps, in anticipation, Bukharin and Rykov. The talk of dark forces is quite clearly an attack on Yazhov, and perhaps Kaganovich and others as well. Orjanikidze worked in his people's commissariat until 2 a.m. the next day, 18th of February. When he got home, he had another equally fruitless conversation with Stalin on the telephone. At 5:30 in the afternoon, he was dead. We are now definitely told in a recent Soviet article that he died of a gunshot wound. His wife, Zinaida, rang Stalin, who soon appeared. He didn't ask a single question, but merely expressed astonishment, "Heavens, what a tricky illness." The chap lay down to have a rest and the result was a fit and a heart attack, thus establishing the official view, confirmed in the medical report, which ran as follows. Comrade Orjanikidze suffered from sclerosis accompanied by serious sclerotic transformations of the cardiac muscle and cardiac vessels, and also from a chronic affection of the right kidney, the only one he possessed after the removal in 1929 of the left kidney owing to tuberculosis. For 2 years Orjanikidze, from time to time, suffered from attacks of stenocardia, angina pectoris, and cardiac asthma. The last such attack, which was a very serious one, occurred at the beginning of November 1936. On the morning of 18th of February Orjanikidze made no complaint about his health, but at 17:30, while he was having his afternoon rest, he suddenly felt ill and a few minutes later died of paralysis of the heart. G. Kaminsky, People's Commissar for Health, USSR. I. Khodorovsky, head of the Kremlin Medical Sanitary Administration. L. Levin, consultant to the Kremlin Medical Sanitary Administration. S. Metz, duty medical officer of the Kremlin Clinic. Of the four signatories, Kaminsky, who, we are told, was very unwilling to sign, was shot later in the year, Khodorkovsky was referred to as a plotter in the Bukharin trial, and Levin actually appeared as a defendant at that trial and was shot afterwards. What happened to the more obscure Mets is unknown. Curiously enough, it was never alleged against the doctors, or anyone else, that Orjonikidze had been a victim of a murder plot by the opposition. It is true that at Orjonikidze's funeral a few days later, Khrushchev was to remark, "It was they who struck a blow to thy noble heart. Pyatakov, the spy, the murderer, the enemy of the working people, is caught red-handed, caught and condemned, crushed like a reptile by the working class, but it was his counter-revolutionary work which hastened the death of our dear 162. Sergo. Equals. And, indeed, the authoritative article on him in the large Soviet encyclopedia, describing him as the favorite comrade in arms of the great Stalin and saying that he died at his post as a warrior of the Lenin-Stalin party, added that the Trotskyite Bukharinite degenerates of fascism hated Orjonikidze with a bitter hatred. They wanted to kill Orjonikidze. In this the fascist agents did not succeed. But the sabotage activity and monstrous treachery of the despicable right, Trotskyite hirelings of Japanese-German fascism greatly hastened the death of Orjonikidze. But nevertheless, no one was ever charged with murdering him. This shows a curious restraint on Stalin's part, though, of course, he may have been saving the case for one of the post-Bukharin trials which never occurred, at least in public. One of Orjonikidze's deputies, Vanikov, was indeed summoned by Azhov a few days after his death, to report on wrecking activities by Orjonikidze. It looks as though there was or had been some notion of posthumously attacking him, as Tomsky and Gamernik had been attacked after their suicides. If so, this too was not pursued. It is now no longer disputed that Stalin did in fact procure Orjonikidze's death. But the details are still debatable. And the way in which the original official version lost credence, first in the defector literature, and finally in the Soviet Union itself, is an interesting demonstration of the relative worth of the sources. Soon after Orjonikidze's death, rumors began to come out of Russia. These varied as to detail, some saying that he had been forced to kill himself under threat of immediate arrest as a Trotskyite, others that he had actually been shot, or poisoned under the supervision of Poskrovichev, Stalin's secretary. Registered for example, Kravchenko, in his book published a decade before Khrushchev's revelations at the 20th Party Congress, says that some believe that he committed suicide, others that he was killed. But no one had any doubt that he died by violence, that his end was not natural. Khrushchev said in 1961 that he had believed what was said about Orjonikidze's heart attack, and only much later, after the war, I learned quite by chance that he had committed suicide. But we know from Soviet sources that the suicide story had circulated widely in the party. Amir Janov, a worker of the Baku Soviet, scarcely a very senior position, was repressed in 1937 because when a certain section of the party active had, already, learned of the suicide story, he had passed it on to an intimate circle of comrades. It was circulating in Kazan prison by April 1937. Registered again. We are told that Nazaridian, one of the first to learn the truth about Orjonikidze's death, was arrested in June 1937 and had already learned it by then. Tilda in the NKVD, too, rumors circulated to the same effect. In the USSR, the natural death version remained official until in February 1956 Khrushchev remarked in his secret speech. Berry also cruelly treated the family of comrade Orjonikidze. Why? Because Orjonikidze had tried to prevent Beria from realizing his shameful plans. Beria had cleared from his way all persons who could possibly interfere with him. Orjonikidze was always an opponent of Beria, which he told Stalin. Instead of examining this matter and taking appropriate steps, Stalin permitted the liquidation of Orjonikidze's brother and brought Orjonikidze himself to such a state that he was forced to shoot himself. This account is clearly misleading. Khrushchev underscore represents Orjonikidze's death as simply due to the failure of an attempt to hamper Beria, as a result of which Stalin turned against him. But at this time, Beria was in the Caucasus, and though he was certainly influential, he played little part in the great affairs of state going on at Politburo level in Moscow. The interest of the 1956 version is elsewhere, in that he was forced to shoot himself. Indeed, Khrushchev himself, when he raised the matter for the first time in a non-secret speech, omitted the Beria angle, which by 1961 was no longer a must. He said, "Comrade Orjonikidze saw that he could no longer work with Stalin, although previously he had been one of his closest friends, circumstances had become such that Orjonikidze could no longer work normally, and in order to avoid clashing with Stalin and sharing the responsibility for his abuse of power, he decided to take his life." This version has not since been amended or contradicted. it may be worth examining the other possibilities. There are, in effect, three stories. Now that natural death has been eliminated, suicide out of despair, a voluntary act, straight murder, and suicide as the result of a threat of worse alternatives by Stalin. Khrushchev implies the first. But it seems reasonable to think that, at most, he is making the best of a forced suicide, just as, in the Kirov case, he could not quite, in a public speech, bring himself to accuse Stalin directly of murder. A close friend of Orjonikidze's widow relates that she thought he had been killed by others, and had seen men running across the lawn away from the house at the time of his death. A Caucasian party official who was in Moscow at the time says that Stalin sent several secret policemen to Orjonikidze, offered him the alternative of arrest or suicide, and gave him a revolver. This account fits in with the fact that a dossier against Orjonikidze had been accumulated. It does not, of course, give any guarantee that the fatal shot was fired by Orjonikidze himself. In fact, there seems no real point in making him shoot himself, when the NKVD men could do that equally easily. One recent Soviet account has it that the first guard on the spot after his death noted that Orjonikidze's revolver had no signs of having been fired, and so reported, being soon shot himself. The stories associating Poskrovichev with the death would be probable, in such circumstances. Orjonikidze could scarcely have been expected to accept a political ultimatum or, indeed, to commit suicide at all, on a threat from a lesser NKVD officer. The presence of Stalin's personal representative is a reasonable idea. Orjonikidze's own NKVD guards must, of course, have been given suitable orders. There was one obvious motive for at least pretending suicide. If the doctors, or any of them, had seen the body and been told it was suicide, it is of course understandable that they could have been induced to hush up the scandal in the interests of party and state. Kaminsky, at least, was to prove a brave critic of the new terror over the months that were left to him. It may perhaps have been his direct connection with the Orjonikidze case which brought him to his moral decision. Hushed up or not, and even taking it a suicide and not murder, at his political level, as candidate member of the Central Committee, he might have guessed what a suicide in those circumstances signified. But if it had obviously been murder, he might well have taken a stronger line. The decisive argument against any but a forced suicide, or murder, is different. If Orjonikidze had felt unable to share responsibility, if he did not want to play the scoundrel as an accomplice in Stalin's plans, it is quite untrue that the only thing to do was to depart, as a Soviet account of the 1960s has it. On the contrary, the Central Committee was to meet the 177. Next day. When, after a postponement, the full plenum met on 23rd of February, some attempt was made to block the purge. The natural, in fact the only thing for Orjonikidze to do was to throw himself into the struggle. Suicide at this moment was pointless. Orjonikidze had been asked to prepare a report for the impending Central Committee plenum. This is still in the archives, and a Soviet historian describes Orjonikidze's draft being returned by Stalin with coarse and hostile comments. This led to stormy exchanges. Another recent Soviet publication suggests that Orjonikidze indeed planned to make a stand against the purges at the February, March plenum, hoping for the support of Postishev, Chubar, perhaps Kalinin. But from Stalin's point of view, the opposite consideration prevailed. An opposition led by an angry Orjonikidze was likely to prove much more difficult to handle than one lacking his support. Voluntary suicide was pointless, but forced suicide, or murder, was logically indicated. A recent article by a Soviet historian tells us that those who saw him on the last day of his life reported him energetic, with no signs of depression, making appointments for the next day, as confirmed by his papers, still in the archives. It is not uninteresting that Vyshinsky described the death of Zinoviev's secretary, Bogdan, who had allegedly been forced to commit suicide under the terms "kill yourself or else we will kill you," as really murder. In this sense, even accepting a forced suicide, we can in any case certainly speak of the murder of Orjonikidze. As I write, the question of whose hand held the gun must be left as recently put by a Soviet historian, that Orjonikidze killed himself, or was shot. On February 19, 1937, the first photographs of Orjonikidze's corpse show, grouped around it, his wife and Stalin's own cabal, Stalin himself, Yazhov, Molotov, Zhdanov, Kaganovich, Mikoyan, and Voroshilov. They all appear overcome with comradely sorrow. A Central Committee announcement the same day spoke of him as an irreproachably pure and staunch party man, a Bolshevik. And Orjonikidze continued to be honored by Stalin, just as Kirov did. There is one curious public sign of the dictator's animus. 7 years later, in 1942, The main towns that had been named after Orjonikidze were quietly rechristened, Orjonikidzegrad, formerly Bezitsa, Orjonikidze, formerly Yenikievo, and Sergo, formerly Kadyivka, reverted to their earlier names, while Orjonikidze in the Caucasus, formerly Vladikavkaz, was given a new Ossetian name, Juadikau. Such action, in the Stalinist protocol, had hitherto invariably been a sign of disgrace, and was to be so in future under his successor as well, when the town of Molotov reverted to Perm, and so on. As to Orjonikidze's relatives, though without publicity, Papalia Orjonikidze's wife, Nina, was sentenced to 10 years on March 29, 1938, and to death on June 14, 1938. Two other Orjonikidze brothers and a sister-in-law were jailed from 1939 through 1941, two other relatives were shot in 1937 and 1938, and another was imprisoned. Yet no further public degradation was inflicted. 5 days after Orjonikidze's death, the Central Committee assembled. In the last trial of strength which now took place, his presence was to be sorely missed among the elements attempting to halt the purge. The February to March plenum. The agenda of the plenum as first circulated consisted of two items. 1. The question of N.I. Bukharin and A.I. Rykov. 2. Organizational questions. Bukharin had already begun to think of suicide, and several times toyed with a revolver long ago presented to him, with ammunition, by Voroshilov. Another of Bukharin's revolvers, as his wife was told in 1939 by Azhov's secretary Ryjova, her cellmate in the Lubyanka, had been fixed so that it could not fire, presumably by the NKVD, which would perhaps have taken the same precaution with this one. Bukharin now went on a hunger strike. Just before the plenum opened, on 23 February, a new agenda was circulated. 1. The question of the anti-party action of Bukharin in connection with his declaring a hunger strike to the plenum. 2. The question of N. Bukharin and A. Rykov. 186. 3. Organizational questions. Livshitz's last words, as he was being led to execution, had been a cry of what for? Or so a story went that now circulated in the upper levels of the party. Army Commander Yakir, a full member of the Central Committee, commented privately when he heard it that the question was a good one, as the men were quite clearly innocent. This appears to have been the mood among some members of the Central Committee as the February, March plenum opened. The atmosphere was extremely tense. Stalin, though, was determined finally to overcome the hesitations and qualms which had for so long held him up and forced him to mark time. The struggle at the plenum is another of the cases in which long-standing rumor was, after decades of official silence, more or less confirmed by Khrushchev in 1956 and 1961. The session was, of course, managed by Stalin's men. The official rapporteurs were Yazhov, Zhdanov, Molotov, and Stalin himself. Formally speaking, they dealt with different subjects, Yazhov with police affairs, Zhdanov with party organization, Molotov with the economic side, while Stalin made the political report. But in practice, all the reports centered on the purge theme, from Yazhov's lessons emerging from the harmful activity, diversion and espionage of the Japanese-German Trotskyite agents, through Zhdanov's condemnation of wrongful methods of expelling party members and Molotov's report on wrecking and sabotage, to Stalin's deficiencies of party work and methods for the liquidation of the Trotskyites and other two-faced people. In fact, there was, in reality, only one item on the agenda, the fate of Bukharin and Rykov. Even now, one or two old colleagues, perhaps still hoping for successful resistance at the plenum, had the courage to show their feelings. Akhilov said to Bukharin, "Play the man." Nikolai Ivanovich, Alborovich pressed his hand. When Bukharin saw Stalin, Stalin told him to apologize to the plenum for his hunger strike and assured him that he would not be expelled. Bukharin then started proceedings by making the appropriate apology, and was then once again violently attacked by Yazhov, Molotov, Kaganovich, and later Kalinin. Yazhov in his report charged Bukharin and Rykov with all the available anti-Soviet crimes, implication in the conspiracies of Zinoviev and Pyatakov, planning the return of capitalism through fascist interventionists, organizing peasant rebellions, inspiring the Ryutin platform, and plotting the murder of Stalin and the overthrow of the Soviet government. Kosir then attacked Bukharin for having helped draft the Ryutin document. Bukharin retorted that he had been in the Pamirs at the time to which Kosir referred, and Kosir replied, "Nevertheless, we must believe Yazhov." Bukharin rejected this and all the other charges, and both he and Rykov bitterly protested their innocence. They did not take the road of repentance. Every point raised against them they denied many times. On 26 February, they made their final defense. Both again denied all the charges. Bukharin is said to have made a strong and emotional speech, agreeing that a conspiracy existed but claiming that its leaders were Stalin and Yazhov, who were plotting to install an NKVD regime giving Stalin. 195. Unlimited personal power. The two men were hotly abused and shouted. 1. Down with cries of to jail. Voroshilov cursed Bukharin. Molotov shouted that Bukharin was proving his fascist affiliations by casting doubt on earlier confessions, and thus supporting anti-Soviet propaganda. Stalin interrupted him, saying that he was behaving in a manner unbecoming to a revolutionary, and he could prove his innocence in a prison cell. Bukharin finally took his seat, saying that even in jail he would not change what he was saying. The plenum appointed a commission of 36 members, with Mikoyan in the chair, and not voting, to report on the question. 20 spoke. Yazhov, supported by 5 others, proposed the expulsion of Bukharin and Rykov from the Central Committee and the party, trial before the military collegium, and execution. Postishev, supported by 7 others, including Petrovsky and Kosyr, proposed the same, without the application of execution. Stalin, supported by 5 others, proposed merely sending them to the NKVD for further investigation. Stalin's proposal was 200. Eventually accepted unanimously. Trademark. A subcommittee, consisting of Stalin, Molotov, Voroshilov, Kaganovich, Mikoyan, and Yazhov, then prepared a resolution. It asserted that as a minimum the NKVD had established that Bukharin and Rykov were aware of the counter-revolutionary activity of the Trotskyite Center, and of other rightists of their own circle. It also accused Bukharin of slandering the NKVD. And it accepted Stalin's formulation of expulsion and handing over to the investigative organs. The resolution then passed, Bukharin and Rykov dissenting. The two men were arrested on the spot and dragged off to the Lubyanka. The search of Bukharin's apartment, unlike those of Zinoviev and Kamenev in 1934, was rigorous, including personal searches of his wife, his father, and the other occupants, though the baby's cot was not disturbed. Boris Berman, now head of an NKVD department, supervised a group of 12 or 13 male and female officers. When they finished, at midnight, they made a convivial supper in the Bukharin's dining room. The plenum continued, with Zhdanov's organizational report. He took the opportunity to criticize sharply the situation in Kiev under Postishev for incorrect leadership and gross breaches of the party constitution and the principles of democratic centralism, the main point being that the Kiev and other organizations had been resorting to co-option instead of election, and that this was extremely undemocratic. During the weeks since January, the indirect attacks on Postishev's position had continued. On 1 February, his close supporter Karpov was denounced as an enemy of the party, a loathsome Trotskyite. Trademark. Over the following weeks, about 60 expulsions of his old nominees from the Kiev party were announced. These lesser figures were more easily removable. They had no old Bolshevik past, and even if their record as Stalinists was a sound one, it was not so widely known throughout the party as to make charges against them sound unbelievable. In attacking men like Karpov, Stalin was undermining Postishev without having the assault made directly. But at the same time, establishing the Trotskyism of the second and third rank Stalinists in the entourages of men he wished to remove, Stalin was setting up precedents which, as resistance weakened, gave him a freer and freer hand to deal with more important men with perfect records. On 8 February came attacks on faults that had been found in the Kiev. 205. Azov, Black Sea, and Kursk provinces. On the following day, lordly and immodest actions that had come to light in the party leaderships in Kiev and Rostov provinces were described. The concentration on Kiev was obvious enough. These attacks had not so far cowed Postishev, and he held himself ready to put his viewpoint. There seems to have been no intention of removing Stalin, but only of curbing him and getting him to abandon Yazhov and the purge. There were precedents in Russian history, but they were not encouraging ones. The boyar, Prince Michael Repnin, had called on Ivan the Terrible to rid himself of his secret police. To our misfortune, you have surrounded your throne with the Oprishnina. Perish the Oprishnina, he said, making the sign of the cross, may he live forever, our Orthodox Tsar. May he rule over men as he ruled them of old. May he spurn, as treason, the voice of shameless flattery. The declaration of loyalty to the ruler and hostility to his secret police was unsuccessful, and Repnin was killed, a lesson to all who undertake such half-measures. Stalin seems to have learned of Postishev's plan in advance. Speaking first, he anticipated and refuted the arguments to be brought against him, and made an appeal for unity and responsibility in the communist leadership. Postishev then went to the platform. In his dry, hoarse and unpleasant voice, he began to read his text. After a careful preamble, he spoke of the excesses of the purge. "I have philosophized that the severe years of the struggle have passed. Party members who lost their backbone broke down or joined the camp of the enemy, healthy elements fought for the party. Those were the years of industrialization and collectivization. I never thought it possible that after this severe era had passed, Karpov and people like him would find themselves in the camp of the enemy. And now, according to the testimony, it appears that Karpov was recruited in 1934 by the Trotskyites. I personally do not believe that in 1934 an honest party member who had trod the long road of unrelenting fight against enemies, for the party and for socialism, would now be in the camp of the enemies. I do not believe it. I cannot imagine how it would be possible to travel with the party during the difficult years and then, in 1934, join the Trotskyites. It is an odd thing." 207. Stalin, who was listening without apparent emotion, uttered a loud interjection, which made it clear to everyone that he was aware of what was going on. This was perhaps the occasion on which Stalin turned to Postyshev and said, "What are you, actually?" To which Postyshev replied, "I am a Bolshevik, Comrade Stalin, a Bolshevik." This reply, in any case, was at first represented in the party as showing lack of respect for Stalin, and later it was considered a harmful act and consequently resulted in Postyshev's annihilation and in his being branded without reason as an enemy of the people, an exaggerated and compressed account. Whatever Stalin said, Postyshev, according to one version, faltered from the text of his speech and later withdrew his doubts. In any case, it is clear that his forlorn hope of swaying the plenum had failed. Yazhov made a wide-ranging report. For instance, he complained that over recent months he could not think of a case in which the economic ministries had telephoned him to express suspicions about any of their staff. On the contrary, they had tried to defend them. A resolution on Yazhov's report was accepted, which repeated Stalin's formulation about the NKVD's failure under Yagoda to act 4 years previously, that is, against Ryutin. "The plenum of the Party Central Committee considers that all facts revealed during the investigation into the matter of an anti-Soviet Trotskyite center and of its followers in the provinces show that the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs had fallen behind at least 4 years in the attempt to unmask these most inexorable enemies of the people." Stalin severely criticized Yagoda. This must have been the occasion when Yagoda turned on the applauding members and snarled that 6 months earlier he could have arrested the lot of them. Orjonikidze's report, to which Stalin had objected, had been supposed to cover sabotage in industry. Molotov, taking up Yazhov's point, now performed this duty, saying that 585 people had been arrested in the People's Commissariat of Heavy Industry alone, and hundreds in other ministries concerned. He sneered at those who urged caution against conjuring up all sorts of conspiracies and sabotage and espionage centers, and called on the party to annihilate enemies of the people hiding behind party cards. "The present-day subversives and saboteurs were especially dangerous," he said, "because they pretend to be communists, ardent supporters of the Soviet regime." On 3 March, Stalin made his political report, and on 5 March a short final speech closing the plenum. These two speeches were printed in full in the press on 29 March in a version believed to differ considerably, chiefly by omission, from what he had actually said. They were later in the year sponsored in England in one volume with a slightly compressed transcript of the Pyatakov trial. Neil MacLean, MP, the British commentator we have already quoted, commented in a preface, "These speeches in that simple and clear style of which M. Stalin is such a master form an interesting background and commentary on the trial." They do indeed. Stalin's report developed the theoretical justification for the terror. Quoting the Central Committee letters of January 18, 1935 and July 29, 1936, he propounded his view, to be denounced in the Khrushchev period, that as socialism gets stronger, the class struggle gets sharper. He pointed out that the fact of there only being a few counter-revolutionaries should not comfort the party. Thousands of people are required to build a big railway bridge, but a few people are enough to blow it up. Tens and hundreds of such examples could be quoted. But his central theme was in effect a censure of leaders who had failed in their vigilance. "Some of our leading comrades, both in the center and locally, not only failed to discern the real countenance of these wreckers, diversionists, spies, and murderers, but proved so unconcerned, complacent and naive, that at times they themselves assisted in promoting the agents of the foreign states to one or other responsible post. The espionage diversionist work of the Trotskyite agents of the Japanese-German secret police," he added, "was a complete surprise to some of our comrades. Our party comrades have not noticed that Trotskyism has ceased to be a political tendency in the working class, that from the political tendency in the working class that it was 7 or 8 years ago, Trotskyism has become a frenzied and unprincipled band of wreckers, diversionists, spies and murderers, acting on instructions from intelligence service organs of foreign states. He made a sinister suggestion, which was to prove a fair statement of his plans. First of all, it is necessary to suggest to our party leaders, from cell secretaries to the secretaries of province and republic party organizations, to select, within a certain period, two people in each case, two party workers, capable of being their real substitutes. His final speech fully implicated Bucharinites as well as Trotskyites. Two words about wreckers, diversionists, spies, etc. I think it is clear to everybody now that the present-day wreckers and diversionists, no matter what disguise they may adopt, either Trotskyite or Bucharinite, have long ceased to be a political trend in the labor movement, that they have become transformed into a gang of professional wreckers, diversionists, spies and assassins, without principles and without ideals. Of course, these gentlemen must be ruthlessly smashed and uprooted as the enemies of the working class, as betrayers of our country. This is clear and requires no further explanation. The bulk of the speech concentrated on a different matter, the censure, in effect, of his next batch of victims. His theme was incorrect conduct, and unjustified expulsions, by leading communists still in high positions. Then, after remarking that we, the leaders, should not be conceited, and should understand that if we are members of the Central Committee or People's Commissars, this does not yet mean that we possess all the knowledge required to give correct leadership. The rank in itself gives neither knowledge nor experience. Still less so does the title. He went on to deal with the unfortunate case of Nikolayenko in Kiev. Nikolayenko is a rank-and-file member of the party. She is an ordinary little person. For a whole year she had signaled about a wrong situation in the party organization in Kiev, exposing the family atmosphere, philistine approach to workers, gagging of self-criticism, high-handed action by the Trotskyite wreckers. She was shunned like a bothersome fly. At last, in order to get rid of her, they expelled her from the party. Neither the Kiev organization nor the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Ukraine helped her to obtain justice. It was only the intervention of the Central Committee of the party which helped to disentangle the twisted knot. And what was revealed by an examination of the case? It was revealed that Nikolayenko was right, while the Kiev organization was wrong. And he added, of the inhuman attitude to such expulsions by some party bureaucrats, only people who are essentially deeply anti-party can have such an approach to members of the party. With these sinister words ringing in their ears, the defeated moderates dispersed to their posts, where worse awaited them. In Postyshev's old fief, a Ukrainian Trotskyite center came to some sort of trials straight away, caught Shabinsky being shot on 8th of March, Galyubenko on 9th of March, and Muzalbas on 10th of March, together with Oped Zinus of the Ukrainian Institute of Marxism-Leninism. Their accomplice V.F. Loganov, named as a prominent Ukrainian Trotskyite, and giving satisfactory evidence as a witness at the Pyatakov trial, was held over and only executed on October 11, 1938. On 17th of March, the Ukrainian Central Committee relieved Postyshev of his post as second secretary. He was demoted to be first secretary in Kuibyshev province. There, though still officially retaining his rank as candidate member of the Politburo, he was to molder, under constant criticism, for a year. The new post was supposed to be an opportunity to correct his errors, it was later to be said, with the verdict that he had failed to measure up. In Kiev, a resolution was passed saying that as a result of Postyshev's leadership, and its un-Bolshevik style of work which suppressed criticism and formed a solid clique, enemies of the party had been able to penetrate 226. The organization and sometimes to persecute honest communists. In the following months, the implications grew. At the Ukrainian Congress in May, Kosyur attacked Postyshev. In Kiev more than anywhere. 227. He said, Trotskyites had been able to gain important posts. Other speakers upbraided those in Kiev who had let in enemies. Over several years of complacency, the main thing had been a personality cult involving greetings to Postyshev. As the restored and rehabilitated Nikolayenko smugly remarked to the uneasy delegates, he had been, in fact, intoxicated with success because of the noise our press made round his 33,229 name. The defeat and demotion of Postyshev was only the beginning. Over the next few years, the great majority, 70%, of the Central Committee which had just seen his final and fumbling stand was to follow Bukharin and Rykov to the death cells. 4. Politically, Stalin's battle had now been won. The way was at last completely open to the total annihilation of the old oppositionists. At the same time, by his actions against Postyshev, He had made the first moves to undermining and destroying that group of his own followers who had hoped to block him. But the main change was that the last attempt to preserve some sort of constitutional procedure had been defeated. In future, he was not to observe any such limitations. In 6 months, the position had changed radically. In the autumn of 1936, Stalin had had to argue and exert pressure to secure the arrest and trial even of potential rivals. Now, he could order the arrest of his closest colleagues without consulting anyone. He could strike when and where he liked, without appeal. The point at which his despotism became an absolute autocracy may be dated as the February, March plenum. There were still steps to be taken to ensure the irrevocability of the victory. The demoralized and defeated rank and file of the Central Committee, convicted of the most capital of all crimes, ineffective disloyalty, had to be mopped up. The purge had so far only affected a limited section of the Soviet people, among whom there remained much political and discipline to be eradicated. And the army remained, to all appearances, wholly obedient, but tyrants have often been misled on this point, and Stalin was soon to insure himself against such a mistake. But first, the instrument of terror needed retuning. The old NKVD of Yagoda's time was technically efficient, but in certain respects it lacked the true Stalinist spirit. In any case, its new master could not trust his predecessor's men. In March, Yazhov ordered the departmental chiefs of the NKVD to proceed to various parts of the country on a massive inspection. Only Slutsky of the Foreign Department and, for the moment, Pauker were not so assigned. The others, leaving shortly afterward, were arrested at the first stations out of Moscow in their various directions, and brought back to prison. 2 days later, the same trick was played on the deputy heads of the departments. At the same time, Yazhov changed the NKVD and all sensitive 230 spots. He had already barricaded himself in a separate wing of the NKVD building, surrounded by a formidable bodyguard and elaborate security. 231 precautions. On March 18, 1937, Yazhov addressed a meeting of senior officers of the NKVD in the secret police club room at the Lubyanka. He denounced Yagoda as a former Tsarist police spy and a thief and an embezzler, and went on to speak of Yagoda's spies in the NKVD. He proceeded to clean up the remaining Yagoda cadres. They were arrested in their offices by day or in their homes by night. Chertok, the bullying interrogator of Kamenev, threw himself from his 12th floor apartment. Other officers shot. 233 themselves, or committed suicide by jumping from their office windows. Most went passively. Bulanov, arrested at the end of March, among them. 3,000 of Yagoda's NKVD officers are reported executed in 1937, Delta, while over the whole period about 20,000 NKVD men fell victim. Of his departmental chiefs, Molchanov, Mironov, and Shannon were to be denounced as rightist conspirators, organized as such in the OGPU in 1931 and 1932, while Pauker, who disappeared in the summer, and Gay were transmuted to spies, together with Pauker's deputy Volovich. Pauker, a Jew, was spoken of as specifically a German spy. On 3 April it was announced that Yagoda himself had been arrested for offenses of a criminal nature in connection with his official duties. Next day, an announcement was made of a new People's Commissar and Assistant People's Commissar of Communications. The transfer of the former Assistant People's Commissar G.E. Prokofiev was also published. Although he was still named as comrade, he was arrested shortly. 242. Afterward as a rightist and later attempted suicide in prison. The wives of both men were also arrested and were sent to a camp. Yagoda's dacha was 244. Taken over by Molotov. Yazhov now had his machine cleared and ready for action. At the same time, the other main element in the purge mechanism, Vyshinsky's prosecutor's apparatus, was being similarly renovated. A number of the old prosecutors had attempted to maintain a semblance of legality. For example, the assistant chief prosecutor of water transport had put in a memorandum on June 26, 1936 urging this. Similar protests were made by a number of provincial prosecutors, for example in Bryansk, where two were arrested for spreading false and defamatory rumors. 90% of the provincial prosecutors were removed, and many of them were arrested. Vyshinsky carried out a mass purge in the organs of the prosecutor's office. With his sanction, many prominent workers in the prosecutor's office who had tried in one way or another to mitigate repressive measures and stop the lawlessness and arbitrariness were arrested and subsequently perished. As late as the beginning of 1938, the ironically titled Stalinist law journal Socialist Legality called for further work in purging fascist agents among the prosecutors. The authorities on Soviet law who had inculcated the formalist attitude to legality were held to responsibility. The Deputy Commissar for Justice, the Soviet Union's leading legal theorist, Ipa Shukhanis, was severely criticized in January 1937 and shot, and in April was to be linked by Vyshinsky with Bukharin as a wrecker who has now been exposed. Another unsatisfactory Deputy Commissar for Justice, V. Adigat, was arrested on July 31, 1937. Sent to camp, he died in 1944. By early spring, all the machinery was in good order. The old communist police and prosecutors, ruthless as they had been, had not proved sufficiently so for the new phase. Russians who had thought that the country was already in the grip of terrorists were now to see what terror really meant. Assault on the army. Ils sont bien ok nos bails sans pour nos propres General the International. On June 11, 1937 it was announced that the flower of the Red Army Command had been charged with treason, and next day that they had been tried and executed. Unlike the victims of the political purges, there had been virtually no public build-up of feeling against the generals. For most people, in the Soviet Union and outside, the news came as a complete and shocking surprise. No details were given of the treason. The campaign appearing in the papers on 12 June could hardly have the effect obtained on previous occasions by months or years of abuse. The newspapers did their best with meetings demanding the death penalty for the foul band of spies. There had already been time for Demian Bedny to compose a 54-line poem including the names of the generals in the rhyme scheme, and in the pages around them, factory demonstrators, the Academy of Sciences, the polar explorers on Rudolf Island, and in fact representatives of the entire community demanded the shooting of the traitors, which had, as it turned out, already taken place. On 15 June, Pravda published Voroshilov's report to a meeting of members of the government and the military Soviet of the People's Commissariat of Defense on the crimes of the soldiers. They had admitted their treacherousness, wrecking and espionage. The men concerned were Marshal Tukhachevsky, Deputy People's Commissar of Defense, Army Commander Yakir, commanding the Kiev Military District, Army Commander Oborovich, commanding the Belarusian Military District, Corps Commander Idman, head of the Civil Defense Organization Osavyakim, Army Commander Kork, head of the Military Academy, Corps Commander Putna, lately military attaché in London, Corps Commander Feldman, head of the Red Army Administration, and Corps Commander Primakov, deputy commander of the Leningrad Military District. In addition, Yan Gamernik, head of the Political Administration of the Red Army and first deputy commissar of defense, whose suicide had been announced on 1 June, was implicated in the alleged conspiracy. The original communique said that the above-named persons were accused of breach of military duty and oath of allegiance, treason to their country, treason against the peoples of the USSR and treason against the Workers' and Peasants' Red Army. There was some discrepancy between these charges and those given in Voroshilov's report, which associates the accused with Trotsky and charges them with preparing the assassination of leaders of the party and government, as well as with espionage. As we shall see, both the Trotskyite and the treason themes had been prepared over many months, and the treason at least was well documented. The accused were all leading members of the group around Tukhachevsky which had pioneered military rethinking through the 1930s. They had developed the ideas and to some degree the organization of an efficient, modern army. The military leaders were still young men. They had been commanding armies while still in their 20s. Apart from Kork, who was just 50, those now seized were all in their 40s. Even now, Tukhachevsky and Putna were 44, Yakir and Oborovich, only 41, the same age as Zhukov, who was to play an important military and political role for many years to come. Gamernik, too, was only 43. Tukhachevsky had by general recognition the finest military brain in the army, and the strongest powers of will and nerve. He came of the minor aristocracy. During the First World War, he had served as a subaltern in the Semyonovsky Guards Regiment. He had been taken prisoner by the Germans in 1915. After five attempts to escape, he was lodged in the security fortress of Ingolstadt, the Colditz of the First World War, where his fellow inmates include young Captain de Gaulle. In 1917, he got back to Russia, where he joined the Bolsheviks. Brilliant, quick of mind, with a streak of cruelty allied to an impetuousness which bordered on the rash, the young Red Army commander cultivated a certain hauteur and an arrogance which was not calculated to ease all his friendships. He was 27 when, in 1920, he commanded the armies attacking Poland, having several times saved the communists on the Eastern Front. He later commanded at Kronstadt and against the Antonov Rebellion in the Tambov region. The Kiev and Belarusian military districts, under Yakir and Oborovich, respectively, were the two largest, containing between them 25 of the 90 rifle divisions and 12 of the 26 cavalry divisions. Yakir, brisk and young in appearance and activity, was the son of a small Jewish chemist in Kishinev. He had organized a Bolshevik band in the Ukraine when only 21, and had risen within 3 years to command the so-called Fastolf army groups against the Poles. From 1926, he had commanded the key Ukrainian